stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest? Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We ask that question every day. What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? We would love to have you answer that question for us. Pick up the phone and give us a call. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-EWTN. 3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd also love to take your question. That number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. That email address is call to communion. Open line is my other world. Oh, it's called to CTC. CTC at EWTN.com is our email address. We would love to have that email from you. I'm Jack Williams sitting in today for Tom Price. Pedro Quiles producing the program. Your call screener is Vanessa Sanchez. And Rich Jesse III is on social media. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, Dr. David Anders, how are you?
Jack, I'm all right. You know, you're not the only person to confuse CTC and Open Line. I was on the show one time. We had a producer who got confused and ran the Open Line intro music for Call to Communion. We're like, hope no one noticed that.
We have a lot going on between shows and not a lot of time to make it go on, right, so it's exactly. Really funny. Got an email here from Mark, David. He says, what do you think of pre-tribulation rapture theology? I'm guessing not much.
I'm trying to restrain myself here. How about that? You know, not much. Not much at all. Right. For all kinds of reasons, but not the least of which is that look, all of these speculations about the end times and trying to plumb the depths of New Testament apocalyptic literature have over the centuries produced a lot of theories about when the end of the world would come and what it would look like. And, I mean, this is not a recent phenomenon. This has been going on for a long time. And most generations, somebody says, aha, I've got the key. I've figured it out. I've done the math. You know, I looked at Ezekiel and I lined up the charts and I've done all this stuff. And the end of the world is going to come on X day. And by the way, I figured out who the Antichrist is. And you know what? Historically, they've all been wrong. And they keep on being wrong. And yet, you know,
every last one of them
has been wrong. And then some new guy pops up and goes, yeah, but they all did it wrong because they didn't see what I see and it's blank. And he's got the new key and then they're wrong again, right? Christ said no one knows the day or the hour of his coming. And moreover, you know, there is a traditional way of reading these apocalyptic texts. First of all, they obviously reference events that are contemporary with the sacred writer. Right. I mean, and almost every biblical scholar recognizes this. So, you know, to take the most prominent example, the character of the Antichrist or the beasts of the earth and sea that show up in the book of Revelation are really to be understood with the person of Nero Caesar. And there's very, very good textual reasons to think that Nero is the person that's being figured there. And so then the second question is, well, if this stuff is actually at the literal level about events that are contemporary to the sacred writers, then what relevance can these texts have to us, right, if they were kind of exhausted in the first century? And the way the church has usually read them is, yeah, they reference historical events in the first century, but those events are types that correspond to types of spiritual experience that are perennial, that always happen in church history. St. John says, you know, there have been many antichrists. And so, you know, you're worried about some tyrant taking over the world and oppressing the church. Again, like that's never happened before. You know, it's happened plenty of times, and it'll happen plenty more. So you can always find something of value in these texts. And the reason they seem so contemporary is because, well, they speak to realities that are perennial in human experience. But, you know, keep in mind Jesus' admonition. No one knows the day or the hour.
Jason wants to know, what historically happened in the second century in the church? It seems like the church fathers' letters became much longer. Was there a reason for this?
Yeah, so first of all, we don't really have writings from church fathers in the first century, really, at all. We have the texts of the Gospels. We have the letters of St. Paul, right? We have the contents of the New Testament. But the earliest post-biblical literature that is extant really does date from the beginning of the second century. So things like the letters of Ignatius of Antioch or Clement's letter to the Corinthians, this kind of thing. The collection that's come together known as the Apostolic Fathers, they're not very long. That collection of literature in the early second century, because they're occasional texts, very much like the letters of Paul. You know, Paul would write because there's a specific problem in a particular location, so he writes to address that one issue. Later in the second century, you get longer treatises that are going after, they're not just addressing particular local problems, but they're addressing more global philosophical concerns, and they begin to wax philosophical more, and so you get these longer treatises. And some of us who read these texts wish that they had maybe taken Strunk and White's elements of style in the second century and remember to omit needless words. That's rule number one, you know. But nevertheless, I think that's what happened. And then, of course, by the time you get to the fourth century, you've got church fathers who have been raised in all the finesse of Greek and Roman rhetoric, and they bring all of their skill in professional writing and speaking to bear on the work of theology, and you really begin to see works of literary beauty and magnificence. But none, for example, could hold a candle to Augustine's Confessions, which, in addition to being magnificent theology and autobiography, it's just absolutely scintillating prose. It's just very well written. So it's not a chore to read Augustine. Some of those other guys, not so much.
Yeah. How much, what's the word I'm looking for? How much degradation has occurred through translation and time, do you think?
Well, so first of all, you know, we don't have everything the church fathers wrote by any stretch of the imagination, right? And what we do have, you know, since the 19th century, scholars have worked to create critical editions, you know, of the extant works of the church fathers and other ancient writers, and we have a pretty good idea what they wrote. And you know, every couple of decades, somebody will come up with a new critical edition based on better manuscripts, etc. And of that body of literature, you know, how much of it has been translated into contemporary English? You know, that would be familiar to people today? Well, very little, actually. I mean, if it's a really prominent church father, somebody like Augustine, you'll get some university press that'll turn out a great critical edition and good translations. But for many of these guys, we're stuck with, if you read English, maybe 19th century translations, and that can be kind of cumbersome.
Straight ahead, we'll talk to Hunter in Charlottesville, Virginia, and we've got plenty of time for your calls as well. The number's 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. You know, with an award-winning content and unparalleled news and analysis through a distinctively Catholic lens, EWTN's National Catholic Register is America's most trusted Catholic news source. Subscribe at a limited time savings of over $17 per year, or give a gift subscription to your priest, deacon, relatives, or others. Visit ncregister.com today and click on subscribe to take care of this offer. It's ncregister.com and click on subscribe. One open line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. First up today is Hunter in Charlottesville, Virginia, watching us on YouTube today. Hunter, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Hello, Dr. Anders. So recently I've been reading through some of Genesis, and I was looking at specifically Genesis 5, where it's talking about Adam's descendants, and it's really striking me how they're living these super long lives. Is that symbolic, or is there some deeper meaning we're supposed to be getting from that?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the Catholic doctrine on the interpretation of Scripture is that every Scripture should be approached from at least two angles. There is first the literal sense, and literal does not mean literalistic in the way that fundamentalists take it. Okay, literal means what the sacred author intended to convey, and you know, he may have purposes that are remote from, say, the interests of, let's say, a fundamentalist reading the text. And those kind of purposes should be discovered as a result of historical scholarship, basically. And then there's the spiritual sense of the text. And that spiritual sense is, what does this mean to me today? Right? I mean, so you take passages in the book of Leviticus, for example, that might spell out in nauseating detail the rules for temple sacrifice, for sacrifices that no Christian would ever perform in the temple that no longer exists. And you say, again, how is this relevant to me? Right? The process of rendering such texts, which have a literal meaning in their own context, relevant to Christian life, is the process of reading them under the guidance of the Holy Spirit and the teaching of the church in union with the Christian community and in light of the mystery of Jesus, right? Basically, how does this unite me to Christ? And when you've answered that question, you've got to the spiritual sense of the text. Now, of the two, you can guess which one's far more important. The one that's more important is the spiritual sense, by far. It carries all the weight for Christian life. And then that subdivides again into what the church calls the moral sense, the allegorical sense, which most people have an idea what allegorical means, and then the one that confuses everybody, which is anagogical. But let me just, St. Paul says in the book of Colossians, set your heart not on things below, but things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Think about the anagogical as the one that gets you up above yourself, that kind of turns your head towards heaven, makes you long and aspire for things above. That's the anagogical sense. And those three combined, how can I live the right kind of moral life? How can I find Christ in this? And how can all of this kind of take me above and out of myself and aspire to things of heaven? When I've read the text that way, I've really engaged the fullness of the spiritual sense. And so good Catholic interpreters, and especially the patristic writers that would engage these kind of texts, were always reading them at that level. And so when you get into patristic commentary, sometimes the allegories get quite fanciful. Right? I mean, so not Genesis 5, but say in the account of the creation, when St. Augustine deals with the creation, he sees the literal events of the creation as allegories for events in the human soul and about the story of the foundation of the church and the redemption of Christ. And he starts finding all of these truths that he's drawing out of this literal narrative. And again, you read the exegesis and you're like, I don't know, Augustine, that seems a little bit far-fetched. But nevertheless, that's the way they do it. A good example, a really outstanding example of spiritual reading of the book of Genesis, I mean, I can't think of a better one, is John Paul II's Theology of the Body. I mean, when you read the conclusions that John Paul draws from the text of Genesis, it's quite obvious that he's going way beyond the literal sense of the text, but he does it in a credible way. I mean, he kind of takes you by the nose and leads you and shows you kind of inner logic that can bring forth this really fruitful reflection on the nature of the human person that has all these moral and ethical implications that are really not on the nose, in the text itself. It's a magnificent example of the spiritual reading of the text, John Paul II's Theology of the Body. So again, to your question about what's going on with these people that live 900 years, well, you might know the Harry Belafonte song about Methuselah and what happened to him, and so it makes for good humor. Are we obligated to think that these characters, lived historical lives of 900 years? And I think the answer to that question is no, right? Because there seem to be a lot of things in the first 11 chapters of Genesis that have a kind of mythic character to them. I'm not saying that they all didn't happen, but I'm saying they stand in relationship to the rest of the narrative in a kind of foundational way, giving ideological explanations for human phenomena that have spiritual relevance. And I don't know that you have to read them. Well, I think the Church Fathers did not. I mean, Origen of Alexandria once said, kind of an exaggerated position, he said, throw away the literal sense like the bitter rind of a nut. What really matters is the spiritual. And so you could, you can find in them allegorical passages. Now, I'll give you one that maybe is suggested by the text itself. So, after all these people live these super long lives up until the flood, and then God says, well, I'm going to restrict the human lifespan to 120 years. And the first character in the biblical narrative that is identified as having died at age 120 is Moses. And there's something else kind of interesting that goes on in the text, that Moses is described as a man who lives to be 120 years. And this appellation man that's applied in a kind of abstract way, like almost like Adam, there's a sort of prototypical man character, is sometimes applied in the early chapters of Genesis to these shadowy sort of theophanic characters that seem to exude divinity in some special way. They're not given names. It's just a man shows up and wrestles with Jacob, that kind of language. And it's highly suggestive. And it's, Christian would read that and see overtones, perhaps, of the ultimate man, the second Adam, Christ, who is this man from heaven that transforms human life and restores, as it were, the longevity of that was lost at the Garden of Eden. This seemingly infinite life that never ends comes back to us in the second Adam. Moses, being the person that establishes the covenant, And sort of begins the process of redeeming the human race in Israel, is identified with this kind of language. And of course, he is a sort of proto-Christ. You know, he reflects the Shekinah glory of God. You can't look at his face because he's been in the divine presence. And yet, someone greater than Moses is here. So you can get into these kind of details when you start reading these texts off against later narratives, and then you can see how the Christian church incorporates those in allegorical readings that ultimately point to Jesus. So yeah, I do think there's symbolism going on there. There's allegory going on there. And I think, you know, at the literal level, I'm kind of with Origen.
Next stop for us is Columbus, Ohio. Denise is a first-time caller listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Denise, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, Dr. Anders. I appreciate your show immensely. I know that you have said before that you are Calvinist, and I had a friend who is not Catholic but is looking into the faith, who asked and quoted John Calvin as saying, if we truly believed in the real presence, we would go crawling on our hands and knees to receive the Eucharist. And I don't know how to respond to that.
I wonder if this guy's ever been to Mass, because there are plenty of people crawling on their hands and knees to receive the Eucharist, right? I mean, you ever heard of genuflection, right? I mean, this is a kind of a liturgical sticking point, right? Of course, in Catholic land right now. I mean, there are quite a few people who are advocating for precisely that gesture of reverence at reception of the Holy Eucharist. Ever been to an adoration chapel? You'll see an awful lot of people, you know, on their hands and knees before the Blessed Sacrament. I mean, ever been to Eucharistic adoration in your church? You're going to see a lot of people on their hands and knees in front of the Blessed Sacrament. I mean, I think the charge is, I mean, I agree with the premise, but not the conclusion, because I think the facts are that, yes, Catholics worship and adore the Blessed Sacrament, including with their acts of bodily reverence. Does every Catholic? Of course not. Now, you know, by comparison, Calvin himself had an extremely robust doctrine of the Eucharist. He did not hold the Catholic doctrine. He didn't believe in transubstantiation, but he definitely believed in a doctrine of the real presence as such. And he said explicitly, in reception of the Eucharist, one partakes in a substantial manner. One substantially receives the body and blood of the Lord. Now, he had a funny explanation for how that happened, but he definitely thought he was a sacramental realist, Calvin, you know, but with a twist. And he expected members of his own congregation to treat the Eucharist, an admission to the Eucharist, with that kind of reverence. Now, I spent a great many years studying Calvin and Calvin's Reformation in Geneva, and his number one challenge in his own congregation of Presbyterian Christians in Geneva was to elicit from the population of Geneva what he thought of as the proper reverence shown towards the Eucharist. And if you read the literature on Calvinist Geneva, you know that, like, most of the people didn't go along with him, largely because they didn't like him, right? And there was a deep resentment against this Frenchman coming into Geneva and telling him all what to do. And he wanted to examine everyone in Geneva on their theology and on their submission to him and to the pastorate as a condition of admission to the Holy Eucharist. And he actually lost his job for that in 1537. He got kicked out and then didn't get back until 39. So I think it's a funny charge coming from a Presbyterian, suggests they don't really know the roots of their own tradition and the extent to which their own founders did in fact have a conception of Eucharistic reverence, and the record of their own indifference towards their own doctrine. So in the 19th century, there's an American Reformed theologian named it's a companion of Schaff. My mind just went blank. He wrote the book, The Mystical Presence. It'll come to me. I'll get you in a minute. Anyway, is one of the Mercersburg theologians who was trying to call modern Presbyterians back to a knowledge of the of the reverence and nobility that early reformers had, in which they had held the Eucharist. I can't believe I can't remember the name of that book.
I agree with everything.
John Williamson Nevin. That's the text. That's the writer.
I agree with everything you just said, certainly. But what about another aspect that comes to mind as you're going through that, is that outward displays of piety should not be the only component with which one tries to discern someone's interior faith.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I mean, I wasn't going to get into it because the charge was that shouldn't you be on your knees,
yeah,
right? But I mean, my own personal conviction is that the reverence that Christ calls us to in the Eucharist, in which St. Paul discusses explicitly in 1 Corinthians as the proper disposition for reception, is not bodily posture, but charity. Mm-hmm. Charity towards one's neighbor, charity towards the Catholic in the pew next to you. And that the most proper mode for reception of the Holy Eucharist is one done in love.
Thanks so much, Denise. We appreciate the phone call. 833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number. Laura is another first-time caller in Boise, Idaho, watching us today on YouTube. Laura, thanks for calling. You're on with Dr. Anders. Laura, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, go right ahead, Laura.
Yes, sorry. Thank you, Dr. Anders. Hopefully you can answer my question. So purgatory, it ends when Jesus Christ comes, and hell is eternal. I'm stuck wondering, how do the bodies, your flesh, how do the bodies pay for the sins in purgatory? Because the ones in hell, they pay because the body's going to unite with the soul, and so they're going to pay for their sins in the flesh. How do the souls in purgatory do the same?
Yeah, okay, thanks. A couple things to disentangle here. One of them is that in purgatory, souls don't have bodies. Right, because this takes place, purgatory is before the bodily resurrection. So the suffering in purgatory is in the soul, it's not in the physical body. There's no physical body till the resurrection. Secondly, you shouldn't analogize the suffering church in purgatory with the damned in hell, as if they were just sort of quantitatively different degrees of the same species. They're fundamentally different, right? Hell is punishment, like it's unremitting punishment for the unremitted guilt of sin and alienation from God. Purgatory is the opportunity to do penance, which is a very different kind of logic and self-purification. So think of it this way, you know, it's like the difference between the kind of discomfort that you might get at the gym from working out hard. That we have a real positive goal and you're engaged by it and you're interested in it and you feel good about yourself. But I mean, it's sort of physically discomforting when you get the lactic acid buildup in your thighs when you're doing those leg extensions, right? Compared to someone who is in a state of physical degradation because they abused their body with drugs and alcohol and stayed away from the gym their whole life. Like, both these people might have the experience of pain or discomfort, but they're qualitatively different, and they're psychologically profoundly different, because one of them is embraced positively for its beneficial ends, and the other, of course, is just hated and resisted because it's nothing but the degradation of the body and loss of independence and things like that. So they're very, very different, qualitatively different kind of situations. Some of the saints, like Catherine of Genoa, have suggested that the souls in purgatory are vastly happier than any soul on earth. And that makes a great deal of sense to me, personally, because remember, if you're a soul in purgatory, there's one thing that you absolutely know for sure. You're going to heaven. You have zero anxiety, not one iota of anxiety, and you're completely united to God in charity. So how often does it happen in this life that I experience suffering and I am completely confident? I don't just mean intellectually confident. I mean, I have embraced the concept into the fiber of my being that this is God's good will for me to save me. I mean, I know I should feel that way, but it's hard to do sometimes. But the souls in purgatory have that conviction. I am 100% certain that whatever this trial is that I'm going through is God's loving plan for my salvation, which is assured. And they know that in the depths of their bones, but they don't have bones, right? In the depths of their soul, right? Whereas the soul in hell knows with just as much certainty that I will never be saved, that I am permanently cut off from the source of all life, love, and happiness, and it's my own darn fault.
833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. 833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Right back to the phones we go. Sebastian is another first-time caller in Ventura, California, listening on John Paul II Radio. Sebastian, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. It's always something that bothers me in our relation to God. We're all sinful. We're all proud and whatnot. But I sometimes feel that we're in a relation of dependence on God in a good way, but also in this way I feel kind of bad in that, okay, we're born with two strikes against us. What am I referring to? First, original sin. And so we gravitate towards what is not good first. And then secondly, our own faults. So I kind of feel we're like a Sisyphus figure. You know, we're pushing that boulder up the hill. We get to the top of the hill, we roll right down again. And it's, you know, with few exceptions, I think most people, really don't scale the heights of holiness. What do you think of that?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So there is a lacuna, that is to say an absence, a lack, a blank, in my judgment, in the catechesis that most Catholics receive if they are, you know, Sunday Mass going attending Catholics, and they don't spend a lot of time sort of reading in the larger tradition. There's something that's sort of left out oftentimes in the Sunday homily, and I don't know why it's left out, but I have only once encountered this doctrine in a homily, and that's what we call the Church's spiritual theology. We know the moral theology more or less. You know, we know we're not supposed to murder and commit adultery and steal and lie and rob and that sort of thing. But we're not given a lot of instruction on, well, how do you actually stop doing those things other than just the application of willpower, which always fails, followed by penance. And anyone who's spent any time in the confessional on either side of the screen will tell you that people go into the confessional and they repeat the same darn sins every week or every month for their entire lives. And it's the whole thing seems after a while to be a bit exhausting, right? And what are we missing here? And I think we are missing something, and it's something that the Church has actually written and talked about a lot, and I don't know why we don't teach it more, and it's what I call spiritual theology. Spiritual theology is the theology of the passage of the soul from sin to righteousness, and the Church actually has a pretty well-developed conception of how that happens. And traditionally, it's said that it happens in more or less three stages. And there are different names for the stages, depending on whether you're in the Latin or Greek tradition. But in the Latin West, we talk about the purgative stage, the illuminative stage, and the unitive stage. And in the purgative stage, people have a kind of, I think, naive conception of what purgation would look like. And it might involve a lot of penitential practices and flagellating myself. That may or may not be effective. All right, the fathers had a more robust conception of what we're aiming for in the purgative stage. Yes, you want to go through ascetical exercises and fast and pray and these kinds of things. But the goal, there's a positive intent. What am I trying to accomplish? I'm not just sort of flagellating myself for no reason or with no aim. The objective is a specific state of mind that the Greeks called apatheia and the Latins called dispassion. And it would be like, it would be like Stoic indifference, but it's more like Stoic indifference with a benevolent God thrown in. And that's exactly how Ignatius of Loyola will talk about it. He talks about, in Spanish, he calls indiferencia is the word that he uses. It's coming to a place in your life where you can actually say, you know, I'm okay with things the way they are. You know, I didn't get the raise at work. I didn't get my high school girlfriend that I wanted to marry me. Maybe I didn't get the health that I wanted. In my own personal case, I went out, Jack would appreciate this story. I went out for every sport you could go out for as a grammar school student. And I was like on the bench in every single one of them. You know, the only medal I ever won on swim team was the medley. Right? Because it's the one that didn't depend on my skill, right? You know, and try as I might, athletics was just not going to be my thing, you know? And coming to the point in your life when you go, okay, I can accept that acceptance. And Christ in the garden, you know, not my will, but thine be done, or the Blessed Virgin Mary, be it done to me according to thy will. And so it's not just detachment for detachment's sake, it's detachment for the sake of coming to this point of acceptance that everything that happens is in accord with God's will and it's good and I can live with it, even if it doesn't go according to my plans. And when you come to that acceptance, you know, you begin to be able to let things go that would otherwise have been just of the utmost importance to you. I mean, and most of our lusts and our drives have, they're not just, they have a bodily aspect to them, but behind them there's usually a conception of what I think I'm entitled to. Well, I deserve this pleasure or that advance or that recognition or that raise or that whatever. And when I can come mentally to the place where I can say, you know, I accept my lot in life that God, that the providence has given to me. And then you've really reached that stage of apatheia. Now, you talk about people take a long time to get here. Evagrius Ponticus, who's the monastic theologian to which we owe most of the development of this stuff, said that in his own life, he felt like he only came to apatheia, you know, like in the last year of his life. And he worked on this stuff for a long, long time. And the Desert Fathers, I mean, they committed a tremendous amount of energy and spiritual practices to this attainment of dispassion or apatheia. Beyond the apatheia, beyond dispassion, the second stage in growth in the spiritual life is the illuminative phase. And illumination is something that comes from above. It's not something we can manufacture. It's a supernatural state. But in essence, Paul talks about it all the time, St. Paul in his letters. He calls it having the mind of Christ. It's a supernatural transformation when I begin to come to see the world through Jesus' eyes. So not only do I get detached from my own will and my own, you know, expectations, but I start to value things differently because I'm taking on Christ's perspective. Pope Francis said in his encyclical on faith that faith isn't just gazing at Jesus, it's coming to see the world through Christ's eyes. You know, when the person that I used to formerly see as, you know, is uncouth, now I can look at as like refreshingly honest.
Thank you.
All right. I have something like that, you know. The person who annoys you, you now come to see as someone who, you know, maybe is really in need of a friend because they don't know how to relate to others, you know. And your whole disposition begins to change, become one of compassion and openness and acceptance and accompaniment and you know, all of the peccadilloes of your neighbor that used to bug you so much and all of your righteous indignation, suddenly you begin to see are trivial compared to your own faults. These kinds of mental shifts in consciousness that are really at the root of charity. And then the final stage, of course, is the unitive stage, where having undergone these transformations, your heart really begins to beat in union with the heart of God. And you know, you begin to value what God values and to really sort of see the world in that perspective. And when that takes place, you know, sin just sort of drops away. And that is the Catholic doctrine, that perfection is an attainable goal. And, you know, it's like a person might be tempted by a certain kind of sexual immorality early in their life. And you would hope that they would come to eventually become so in love with their spouse that the thought of any other kind of alternative would become unthinkable to them, you know, because they were so consumed by a different vision of human intimacy that was so much more noble. Theologians talk about a difference between continence and temperance, right? Continence just means, you know, you're able to restrain yourself, but temperance means you can do it easily. Continence can happen with some degree of willpower and maybe taking some steps to remove you from centers of temptation. Temperance comes when you really begin to love the virtue for its own sake because you see how much happiness it brings, right? And again, the church has practices and it has guides, it has mentors in this walk of the spiritual life. And, you know, most Catholics are just unfamiliar with this whole body of thought that's so rich in the Catholic mystical and monastic traditions that we should avail ourselves of. So, you know, here's some good forays into this literature. So, really accessible spiritual writer in the Catholic tradition, Father Jacques Philippe. Lots of books by Father Jacques Philippe, which are really good introductions to this kind of thinking. You know, if you've never been on an Ignatian retreat, it's all about this kind of stuff. Father Timothy Gallagher who does the Ignatian stuff?
Does a great job.
The Ignatian stuff for lay people, you know.
That's available on demand at EWTN.com.
In fact, you know, as I was walking into the studio today, I was walking past somebody's office and they're editing some project, and I looked and I was like, that's Father Gallagher.
That's right. Awesome. Thanks so much. We appreciate the phone call. Next up is Rosa in Chicago, Illinois, listening on the EWTN app. Rosa, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, I'm here. I have a question on how we can respond to the current immigration things that are going on as Catholics when people come against let's say me in particular, and say, how can you have voted for Trump, let's say, or how can you agree with this? What is our Catholic belief here, or what do we say?
Absolutely. Thank you. So I know what you're talking about, and I have, I used to work in, I used to work for a diocesan chancery, and in that job I would sometimes interview candidates for other positions. And I remember having conversations with some candidates one time and for a particular position, and you know, one set of that I was talking to was like, well, I just don't understand how anybody could be Catholic and vote for X. And then somebody else would come in and say, I don't see how anybody could possibly be Catholic and not vote for X, you know, and we're talking about the same X, right? And it just goes to you know, this is not just a Catholic problem, this is a human problem, right? And when we get engaged in our ideologies, whether they be ideologies on the right or the left, I mean, the great danger of ideology is that all ideologies are reductive in the way they construe human problems, because they run on a theory, and you have to make the facts fit your theory, right? And when they don't fit, you just lop off the bits that don't fit, and sometimes people get lopped off in the process. And because of that, the church is emphatic that we should not reduce moral theology to the category of political ideology. And so anytime somebody says, well, the Catholic position is, and then they give you essentially a sort of a policy prescription for how you should organize society down to the fine particulars, well, you're probably dealing with an ideologue. And even more so when they say, and anybody that disagrees with me is Satan or the Antichrist or the horrible person, right? It is possible to construe a moral dilemma in more than one way. And it is more than likely that people of goodwill will disagree. And to take something that's very remote from our situation, but to illustrate this, two really great Catholic luminaries from the early 20th century that people at EWTN, like, we would read these guys, both of them, and think they were great, right? One would be the Catholic philosopher Jacques Maritain, absolutely famous Catholic philosopher, Thomist philosopher. Another one would be the Thomistic neo-scholastic theologian Gary Gulagrange. They were both French. They used to be friends. Then they had this massive falling out over democratic republicanism in France after the World War II. And Lagrange was essentially a monarchist, and Maritain was a Democrat. And they just could not see how the other one couldn't see reality the way they saw it. And they had a complete split. And they were both devout, faithful, Orthodox Catholics. And they absolutely came to blows over, you know, an issue in contemporary French politics. So this has been going on for a long time. What John Paul II said, he wrote an encyclical, not on this topic, but he touched on it. It was called Solicitudo Reo Socialis. It was a social encyclical. And he says, the church's moral theology is not political ideology. It's not left wing. It's not right wing. It's not someplace in the middle. It's a different category. It's a category mistake to reduce Catholic moral thinking to these political categories. So what do you do instead, right? So what the church says is, look, the church will teach you the moral principles, okay? And above all is the principle of the dignity of the human person. I mean, that is like principle A number one in Catholic moral thinking, dignity of the human person. And we'll teach you the principles. It is up to policymakers to put them into practice. And because cultures change and societies change and circumstances change, the church is not going to give you the one formula that works in every nation, every place, every time. It is possible to have a Christian democracy. It's possible to have a Christian monarchy. It'd be possible to live in a Christian tribe. I mean, there are lots of different ways humans can organize themselves and still follow the basic principles of Catholic moral theology. And it is okay for Catholics to disagree on political questions. What's not okay is to say, my way of construing reality is the only way possible, and anyone who deviates from me in the slightest is obviously in league with Satan. And so, you know, if you have strong moral convictions drawn from your Catholic faith about the current political situation, I would encourage you to think critically about them, read widely, and not just people you agree with, and have open-minded conversations with people of goodwill who want to see justice done and dignity served, and allow ourselves to enter into not just a debate, but a dialectic. You know, debate is, I want to win. I want to crush my opponent and show him I'm right. Dialectic is, I'm open to the possibility that I might not have the whole truth. And you and I together will take different points of view in the hopes that we might elicit from one another a deeper understanding. St. Thomas called dialectic, not the argument from first principles, but the search for first principles. It's a very different way of thinking about it. And hopefully bring some civility back to our very fractured American political landscape, which I think is just terrible.
Well, I wanted to give you a little heads up Anybody who listens to EWTN Radio every single Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, EWTN's Open Line is hosted by Father of Mercy, Father Wade Menezes, no stranger to EWTN viewers. We talk faith, family, and fellowship every Tuesday, so be sure to check it out. Tuesdays, EWTN's Open Line with Father Wade Menezes right here on EWTN Radio and sometimes television. Andrew is up next. He's in Omak, Washington, listening on the EWTN app. Andrew, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi. Could you explain the sin of pride in more detail in respect to, is it sinful to be proud of our accomplishments? And also, what part of pride is sinful and what part of pride is good for us? And how do we make that distinction, especially with a person who might be prone to low self-esteem or depression?
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. Great question.
So
English language does not serve us well here, I think. We need two different words. We need two different concepts to describe two very different things, and the language isn't helping us. It only gives us one word. But we're really talking about two radically different things. So, you know, neurologically, psychologically, the psychologists talk about a state of mind called flow. I'm sure you've heard of flow. You know, flow is when the mountain climber who's scaling the heights, you know, kind of loses himself in the altitude and the sweat and the challenge and the exhilaration of it all, and time seems to stop and he seems to be outside of himself and he's so taken up that he feels like he could say plaster to the side of this mountain forever. Or the surfer, I've heard Peter Kreeft talk about this. He used to surf back in the day. You know, you catch the perfect wave and you just feel like the universe is converging on your board and you feel like one with the sea and the sand and it's just beautiful. Or, you know, the musician who is just mastered a really difficult piece and is playing, you know, just beyond the edge of their skill level, and they seem to, you know, enter into this timeless Pythagorean world of symbol and note and harmony, and they lose themselves in that beauty. And we've all had these kinds of experiences. So the tennis player, I've never had this one, the tennis player who just, you know, absolutely nails the perfect serve, and, you know, just he doesn't even notice his arm anymore because he's just at one with the motion and the ball. And we obviously experience just an intense form of satisfaction. It's one of the most satisfying states of mental life that a human being can experience. And it's deeply positive for people, and it's associated with all kinds of benefits to their physical and mental health. And when people operate at that level of accomplishment, they also just do good in the world. I mean, they produce more content that's of more benefit to more people. And there's one thing the Catholic Church and Catholic philosophy has always said and has been emphatic about, and that is that goodness is good without qualification, right? Goodness is good without qualification. And moreover, that when I produce or enjoy a genuinely good thing for goodness' sake, that it is a participation in the very goodness of God. And so it's entirely appropriate, I think, for someone who's trying to accomplish a task or to engage a skill or to master a procedure, to acknowledge the goodness and the benefits that comes with the psychological engagement and the positivity that flows out of that, and to be intensely happy that they're making progress and that they've you know, maybe made a new personal best or whatever it might be. And that sense of, if you want to call that pride, is just such a singular source of benefit. It's hard to imagine human life and accomplishment and culture and beauty ever existing without it. I mean, can you imagine if Michelangelo didn't actually like the artwork he was producing? He couldn't have made it. It'd be impossible, right? The kind of obsessive interest in the mastery of one's craft that's necessary for operating at the heights of human performance, it would be impossible without that kind of positive engagement, excitement, thrill, and if you want to call it that, pride, okay? The sin of pride is something vastly different. And you know, you can be a real nincompoop with no skills and have the sin of pride, right? The sin of pride is when we want ourselves and our accomplishments to be valued or valorized by others way beyond their intrinsic merits, and to the detriment of others, because we want our standing relative to them to be higher. You know, so it's one thing, you know, I'm a terrible athlete, I'm a almost equally terrible musician, but I'm marginally better as a musician than I am as an athlete. And, you know, they were kind enough to let me into the EWTN choir many, many years ago. But I was very keenly aware that, like, I was the one non-professional in the group, you know. And if my enjoyment of that choir had been dependent on my ability to perform at the level of the professional tenors in there, I would have hated myself and wanted to go home and bury my head under a pillow, right? So I learned a long time ago, you know, I'm going to enjoy this at the level that I can do it because the behavior itself is intrinsically valuable. And I will count my progress against myself. I'll measure against the only benchmark that matters, and that's me, right? And but if I had said, well, you know, obviously I should be given the solo. Well, that's far from obvious, right? I mean, like, you don't want me doing the solo, right? That's pride. That's what Jesus talks about, wanting to have the top seat at the table. Go get to the bottom seat of the table, and then maybe the master of the house will move you farther up, right? You'll move you in a different place. But when I want that place that doesn't naturally belong to me, all eyes have to be on me, and I want to be valued beyond my own intrinsic merits. That's the sin of pride.
Next up is George in Oil City, Pennsylvania, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. George, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm a 75-year-old fellow, and when I was a young lad, an older server, had a priest that you didn't know whether he was going to make it through the Mass or not. So the thought came, well, when does transubstantiation actually occur? I've had three different answers over the time. One was when the priest puts his hand over the chalice, the other one when he raises the host, and then the wine, and then the third answer was all three.
It's the words of consecration. It's the words of consecration. Transubstantiation occurs with the words of consecration.
Which are?
Oh. This is my body. Right.
Thank you. We appreciate that, George. Next up is Jonathan, a first-time caller in Burbank, California, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Jonathan, you're on with Dr. David Anders. Jonathan, are you there? Tell you what, we'll head to Kim in Salina, Kansas. She's listening on Sirius also, Sirius XM Channel 130. Kim, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hello, Mr. Anders. I have a question for you about my mother.
Yes.
She was raised Mormon and was baptized in the Mormon church. She left the Mormon church when she got married. And it's complicated now because she has dementia. But my question is, do you consider that a valid baptism?
Right. Now, I'm assuming the Presbyterians did not baptize her. Is that correct?
It was in the Mormon church.
Right.
Nope.
Okay. Nothing ever happened to the Presbyterian church. Okay. The Catholic church would not consider Mormon baptism to be valid. The Catholic church, it considers most non-Catholic baptisms valid, but not Mormonism, because the Mormon doctrine of God and of the Trinity and what they mean by the words, the form of baptism is so different from historic Christianity that it's a fundamentally different rite. So the question is, then, how do you regard the state of your mother? And you know, I think the church's attitude here would be one of tremendous generosity. I mean, not validly baptized, but, you know, she left the Mormon church, joined a more traditional historic Christian faith, and presumably came to share its Trinitarian faith. And so, you know, her lack of valid baptism, I think, is a matter of ignorance on her part. It's not her own fault. And there would be a kind of implicit desire for baptism, and the church recognizes the value of, you know, baptism by desire. Obviously, if she were competent, if she were capable of asking for sacramental baptism, that would be appropriate. If she's not capable of asking for it, then we will entrust her to the mercy of God.
In the interest of time, I'm going to ask Jonathan's question for him in Burbank, California. He wants to know what the Catholic position is on souls that pass away. What are they doing?
Yeah, so the Catholic Church teaches that the departed definitely continue in conscious existence in one of three states. Either they enter the beatific vision and to eternal bliss and joy, but still have the resurrection to look forward to, or they go to purgatory, or they go to hell.
Very good. Well, David, thanks as always for being so gracious with
Thank
your time.
You. Thank you.
We asked this question on EWTN's Call to Communion. What's stopping you from becoming Catholic? And we would love to have you answer that question for us. So file away the phone numbers. The numbers are 833-288-EWTN. That's toll-free, 833-288-3986 to be live on the program. If you happen to be outside the United States and Canada, you can still call in. That number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email. That email address is ctc@ewtn.com. That's ctc@ewtn.com. On behalf of our host, Dr. David Anders, our producer, Pedro Quiles, our call screener, Vanessa Sanchez, and our social media maven, Mr. Rich Jesse, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for tuning in. Can't wait till next time when we ask that same question, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic, on Call to Communion.